Hello and thank you for tuning into Bricada Circle, your tribe of storytellers for nonprofit organizations. We're broadcasting on Party 93.4. Bricada is a word in the Filipino language that means best friends. Bricada Circle is a community of artists who are passionate about helping nonprofit organizations tell their stories in more compelling ways to engage people into becoming active supporters, volunteers, and donors who want to create real positive impact in their communities. I'm Panangara, your main mixologist for Bricada Circle. You can listen to a podcast of this program and broadcasts of other artists on this station by going to party934.com and clicking on the podcast page. I would also like to invite you to check out my blog on bricadacircle.com, where I talk about storytelling for nonprofits, fundraising, and how to grow your organization's impact and value for the community. Since the beginning of human history, stories have shaped culture and people's way of life. It's where their identity is deeply rooted. It's how families, tribes, and communities keep their legacies alive. It's been said that when an elder dies, it's as if a library has burned. Anthropologist Elizabeth Kapu'uwailani Lindsay wants the world to remember the people who came before us. The actor-turned-anthropologist has made it her mission to find, preserve, and share the knowledge and traditions of indigenous populations before they disappear, to keep ancestral voices alive. She's working with Google to create a geospatial map of the human story, using the indigenous signs of wayfinding to chart tales at risk of being lost. As the first female fellow and first Polynesian explorer at the National Geographic Society, Elizabeth Lindsay had set out on a 186-day global expedition in 2011 to document what she called teachings critical to navigating the complexity of our times. Lindsay's 1996 documentary entitled Then There Were None, which chronicled the near extinction of Native Hawaiians, has become a must-see in many history classrooms. She was named Hawaii's Woman of the Year in 2004. Let's listen to Elizabeth Lindsay and Curating Humanity's Heritage.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features explorer and ethnographer Elizabeth Lindsay. Here's Elizabeth Lindsay.
As a child, I was raised by Native Hawaiian elders, three old women who took care of me while my parents worked. The year is 1963. We're at the ocean. It's twilight. We're watching the rising of the stars and the shifting of the tides. It's a stretch of beach we know so well. The smooth stones on the sand are familiar to us. If you saw these women on the street in their faded clothes, you might dismiss them as poor and simple. That would be a mistake. These women are descendants of Polynesian navigators, trained in the old ways by their elders, and now they're passing it on to me. They teach me the names of the winds and the rains, of astronomy according to a genealogy of stars. There's a new moon on the horizon. Hawaiians say it's a good night for fishing. They begin to chant. Eho mai ka hiki mai luna mai e o na me hu na no e o. O nā mele, e ho mai, e ho mai, e ho mai e. When they finish, they sit in a circle and ask me to come to join them. They want to teach me about my destiny. I thought every 7-year-old went through this. Bebe girl, someday the world will be in trouble. People will forget their wisdom. It will take elders' voices from the far corners of the world to call the world into balance. You will go far away. It will sometimes be a lonely road. We will not be there. But you will look into the eyes of seeming strangers, and you will recognize your ohana, your family, and it will take all of you. It will take all of you. These words I hold on to all my life because the idea of doing it alone terrifies me. The year is 2007. I'm on a remote island in Micronesia. Satawal is 1.5 mile long by 1 mile wide. It's the home of my mentor. His name is Pius Mau Pialuk. Mau is a Palu, a navigator priest. He's also considered the greatest wayfinder in the world. There are fewer than a handful of Palu left on this island. Their tradition is so extraordinary that these mariners sailed 3 million square miles across the Pacific without the use of instruments. They could synthesize patterns in nature using the rising and setting of stars, the sequence and direction of waves, the flight patterns of certain birds, even the slightest hint of color on the underbelly of a cloud would inform them and help them navigate with the keenest accuracy. When Western scientists would join Mao on the canoe and watch him go into the hall, it appeared that an old man was going to rest. In fact, the hull of the canoe is the womb of the vessel. It is the most accurate place to feel the rhythm and sequence and direction of waves. Mao was, in fact, gathering explicit data using his entire body. It's what he had been trained to do since he was 5 years old. Now, science may dismiss this methodology, but Polynesian navigators use it today because it provides them an accurate determination of the angle and direction of their vessel. The Palu also had an uncanny ability to forecast weather conditions days in advance. Sometimes I'd be with Mao on a cloud-covered night, and we'd sit at the easternmost coast of the island, and he would look out. And then he would say, "Okay, we go." He saw that first glint of light. He knew what the weather was going to be 3 days from now. And when the Palu were out at sea, and they knew that a violent storm was approaching, what they would do is they would start to unlash the boards of their vessel so that the waves could come thundering through without destroying the canoe. It was a scary place to be so far from a safe harbor. And then what they would do is they would fasten themselves to these loosened boards and ride out the storm. Imagine that. Their achievements, intellectually and scientifically, are extraordinary. And they are so relevant for these times that we are in when we are riding out storms. We are in such a critical moment of our collective history. They have been compared to astronauts, these elder navigators who sail vast open oceans in double-hulled canoes thousands of miles from a small island. Their canoes, our rockets, their sea, our space. The wisdom of these elders is not a mere collection of stories about old people in some remote spot. This is part of our collective narrative. It's humanity's DNA. We cannot afford to lose it. The year is 2010. Just as the women in Hawaii that raised me predicted, the world is in trouble. We live in a society bloated with data, yet starved for wisdom. We're connected 24/7, yet anxiety, fear, depression, and loneliness is at an all-time high. We must course correct. An African shaman said, "Your society worships the jester, while the king stands in plain clothes." The link between the past and the future is fragile. This I know intimately because even as I travel throughout the world to listen to these stories and record them, I struggle. I am haunted by the fact that I no longer remember the names of the winds and the rains. Mao passed away 5 months ago, but his legacy and lessons live on. And I am reminded that throughout the world, there are cultures with vast sums of knowledge in them, as potent as the Micronesian navigators, that are going dismissed. This is a testament to brilliant, brilliant technology and science and wisdom that is vanishing rapidly, because when an elder dies, a library is burned, and throughout the world, libraries are ablaze. I am grateful for the fact that I had a mentor like Mao who taught me how to navigate. And I realize through a lesson that he shared that we continue to find our way. And this is what he said. The island is the canoe. The canoe, the island. And what he meant was, if you are voyaging and far from home, your very survival depends on everyone aboard. You cannot make the voyage alone. You were never meant to. This whole notion of every man for himself is completely unsustainable. It always was. So in closing, I would offer you this. The planet is our canoe, and we are the voyagers. True navigation begins in the human heart. It's the most important map of all. Together, may we journey well.
That was Elizabeth Lindsay, recorded at TED in December of 2010. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. You can follow us on twitter.com/party93.4 and facebook.com/party93.4. Our lives and our cultures are composed of many overlapping stories. Inspired by Nigerian history and tragedies, the novels of Chimamanda Adichie are jewels in the crown of diasporan literature. In her works, she seeks to instill dignity into the finest details of each of her characters, whether poor, middle class, or rich, exposing along the way the deep scars of colonialism in the African landscape. After reading Adichie's early novel entitled Half of a Yellow Sun, Igbo literary giant Chinua Achebe said this about Adichie's work: "We do not usually associate wisdom with beginners, but here is a new writer endowed with the gift of ancient storytellers." In this inspiring talk, Chimamanda Adichie tells the story of how she found her authentic cultural voice and warns that if we hear only a single story about another person, we risk a critical misunderstanding. Here is Chimamanda Adichie talking about the danger of a single story.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference. This episode features writer Chimamanda Adichie. Here's Chimamanda Adichie.
I'm a storyteller, and I would like to tell you a few personal stories about what I like to call the danger of the single story. I grew up on a university campus in eastern Nigeria. My mother says that I started reading at the age of 2, although I think 4 is probably close to the truth. So I was an early reader, and what I read were British and American children's books. I was also an early writer. And when I began to write at about the age of 7, stories in pencil with crayon illustrations that my poor mother was obligated to read, I wrote exactly the kinds of stories I was reading. All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow. They ate apples. And they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria, had never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow, we ate mangoes, and we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. My characters also drank a lot of ginger beer because the characters in the British books I read drank ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have a desperate desire to taste ginger beer. But that is another story. What this demonstrates, I think, is how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. Because all I had read were books in which characters were foreign, I had become convinced that books, by their very nature, had to have foreigners in them and had to be about things with which I could not personally identify. Now, things changed when I discovered African books. There weren't many of them available, and they weren't quite as easy to find as the foreign books, but because of writers like Chinua Achebe and Kamara Laye, I went through a mental shift in my perception of literature. I realized that people like me, girls with skin the color of chocolate, whose kinky hair could not form ponytails, could also exist in literature. I started to write about things I recognized. Now, I loved those American and British books I read. They stirred my imagination, they opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this: it saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor, my mother was an administrator. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music, and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this: she had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection as human equals. I must say that before I went to the US, I didn't consciously identify as African. But in the US, whenever Africa came up, people turned to me, never mind that I knew nothing about places like Namibia. But I did come to embrace this new identity, and in many ways, I think of myself now as African, although I still get quite irritable when Africa is referred to as a country, the most recent example being my otherwise wonderful flight from Lagos 2 days ago, in which there was an announcement on the Virgin flight about their charity walk in India, Africa, and other countries. So after I had spent some years in the US as an African, I began to understand my roommate's response to me. If I had not grown up in Nigeria, and if all I knew about Africa were from popular images, I too would think that Africa was a place of beautiful landscapes, beautiful animals, and incomprehensible people fighting senseless wars, dying of poverty and AIDS, unable to speak for themselves, and waiting to be saved by a kind white foreigner. I would see Africans in the same way that I, as a child, had seen Fide's family. This single story of Africa ultimately comes, I think, from Western literature. Now, here's a quote from the writing of a London merchant called John Locke, who sailed to West Africa in 1561 and kept a fascinating account of his voyage. After referring to the black Africans as beasts who have no houses, he writes, "They are also people without heads, having their mouths and eyes in their breasts." Now, I've laughed every time I've read this, and one must admire the imagination of John Locke. But what is important about his writing is that it represents the beginning of a tradition of telling African stories in the West, a tradition of sub-Saharan Africa as a place of negatives, of difference, of darkness, of people who, in the words of the wonderful poet Rudyard Kipling, are half-devil, half-child. And so I began to realize that my American roommate must have, throughout her life, seen and heard different versions of this single story. As had a professor who once told me that my novel was not authentically African. Now, I was quite willing to contend that there were a number of things wrong with the novel, that it had failed in a number of places, but I had not quite imagined that it had failed at achieving something called African authenticity. In fact, I did not know what African authenticity was. The professor told me that my characters were too much like him, an educated and middle-class man. My characters drove cars. They were not starving. Therefore, they were not authentically African. But I must quickly add that I, too, am just as guilty on the question of the single story. A few years ago, I visited Mexico from the US. The political climate in the US at the time was tense, and there were debates going on about immigration. And, as often happens in America, immigration became synonymous with Mexicans. There were endless stories of Mexicans as people who were fleecing the healthcare system, sneaking across the border, being arrested at the border, that sort of thing. I remember walking around on my first day in Guadalajara, watching the people going to work, rolling up tortillas in the marketplace, smoking, laughing. I remember first feeling slight surprise, and then I was overwhelmed with shame. I realized that I had been so immersed in the media coverage of Mexicans that they had become one thing in my mind, the abject immigrant. I had bought into the single story of Mexicans, and I could not have been more ashamed of myself. So that is how to create a single story. Show a people as one thing, as only one thing, over and over again, and that is what they become. It is impossible to talk about the single story without talking about power. There is a word, an Igbo word, that I think about whenever I think about the power structures of the world, and it is nkali. It's a noun that loosely translates to be greater than another. Like our economic and political worlds, stories too are defined by the principle of nkali. how they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told, are really dependent on power. Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. The Palestinian poet Mourid Barghouti writes that if you want to dispossess a people, the simplest way to do it is to tell their story and to start with secondly. Start the story with the arrows of the Native Americans and not with the arrival of the British, and you have an entirely different story. Start the story with the failure of the African state and not with the colonial creation of the African state, and you have an entirely different story. I recently spoke at a university where a student told me that it was such a shame that Nigerian men were physical abusers like the father character in my novel. I told him that I had just read a novel called American Psycho. And that it was such a shame that young Americans were serial murderers. Now, now, obviously I said this in a fit of mild irritation, but it would never have occurred to me to think that just because I had read a novel in which a character was a serial killer, that he was somehow representative of all Americans. And now this is not because I'm a better person than that student, but because of America's cultural and economic power, I had many stories of America. I had read Thailand, Updike, and Steinbeck, and Gaitskill. I did not have a single story of America. When I learned some years ago that writers were expected to have had really unhappy childhoods to be successful, I began to think about how I could invent horrible things my parents had done to me. But the truth is that I had a very happy childhood, full of laughter and love, in a very close-knit family. But I also had grandfathers who died in refugee camps. My cousin, Polly, died because he could not get adequate health care. One of my closest friends, Okuloma, died in a plane crash because our fire trucks did not have water. I grew up under repressive military governments that devalued education so that sometimes my parents were not paid their salaries. And so as a child, I saw jam disappear from the breakfast table. Then margarine disappeared. Then bread became too expensive. Then milk became rationed. And most of all, a kind of normalized political fear invaded our lives. All of these stories make me who I am. But to insist on only these negative stories is to flatten my experience and to overlook the many other stories that formed me. The single story creates stereotypes, and the problem with stereotypes is not that they are untrue, but that they are incomplete. They make one story become the only story. Of course, Africa is a continent full of catastrophes, the immense ones such as the horrific rapes in Congo, and depressing ones such as the fact that 5,000 people apply for one job vacancy in Nigeria. But there are other stories that are not about catastrophe, and it is very important, it is just as important to talk about them. I've always felt that it is impossible to engage properly with a place or a person without engaging with all of the stories of that place and that person. The consequence of the single story is this: it robs people of dignity. It makes our recognition of our equal humanity difficult. It emphasizes how we are different rather than how we are similar. So what if before my Mexican trip, I had followed the immigration debate from both sides, the US and the Mexican? What if my mother had told us that Fide's family was poor and hardworking? What if we had an African television network that broadcast diverse African stories all over the world, what the Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe calls a balance of stories? What if my roommate knew about my Nigerian publisher, Mukhtar Bakare, a remarkable man who left his job in a bank to follow his dream and start a publishing house? Now, the conventional wisdom was that Nigerians don't read literature. He disagreed. He felt that people who could read would read if you made literature affordable and available to them. Shortly after he published my first novel, I went to a TV station in Lagos to do an interview. And a woman who worked there as a messenger came up to me and said, "I really liked your novel. I didn't like the ending. Now you must write a sequel, and this is what will happen." And she went on to tell me what to write in the sequel. Now, I was not only charmed, I was very moved. Here was a woman, part of the ordinary masses of Nigerians who are not supposed to be readers. She had not only read the book, but she had taken ownership of it and felt justified in telling me what to write in the sequel. Now, what if my roommate knew about my friend, Funmi Iyanda, a fearless woman who hosts a TV show in Lagos and is determined to tell the stories that we prefer to forget? What if my roommate knew about the heart procedure that was performed in the Lagos hospital last week? What if my roommate knew about contemporary Nigerian music, talented people singing in English and Pidgin and Igbo and Yoruba and Ijaw, mixing influences from Jay-Z to Fela to Bob Marley to their grandfathers? What if my roommate knew about the female lawyer who recently went to court in Nigeria to challenge a ridiculous law that required women to get their husband's consent before renewing their passports? What if my roommate knew about Nollywood, full of innovative people making films despite great technical odds? Films so popular that they really are the best example of Nigerians consuming what they produce. What if my roommate knew about my wonderfully ambitious hair braider who has just started her own business selling hair extensions? Or about the millions of other Nigerians who start businesses and sometimes fail but continue to nurse ambition? Every time I am home, I am confronted with the usual sources of irritation for most Nigerians: our failed infrastructure, our failed government, but also by the incredible resilience of people who thrive despite the government rather than because of it. I teach writing workshops in Lagos every summer, and it is amazing to me how many people apply, how many people are eager to write, to tell stories. My Nigerian publisher and I have just started a nonprofit called Farafina Trust, and we have big dreams of building libraries and refurbishing libraries that already exist and providing books for state schools that don't have anything in their libraries, and also of organizing lots and lots of workshops on reading and writing for all the people who are eager to tell our many stories. Stories matter. Many stories matter. Stories have been used to dispossess and to malign, but stories can also be used to empower and to humanize. Stories can break the dignity of a people, but stories can also repair that broken dignity. The American writer Alice Walker wrote this about her southern relatives who had moved to the north, and she introduced them to a book about the southern life that they had left behind. They sat around reading the book themselves, listening to me read the book, and the kind of paradise was regained. I would like to end with this thought, that when we reject the single story, when we realize that there is never a single story about any place, we regain a kind of paradise. Thank you.
That was Chimamanda Adichie, recorded at TED in July of 2009. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkada Circle on Party 93.4. A person's identity is rooted in her life stories. It can be liberating, but depending on other people's perceptions, it can also be a challenge of unforeseen proportions. As Director of Research at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, Dalia Mogahed keeps her finger on the pulse of the Muslim world. She served on Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in 2009, advising the president on how faith-based organizations can help governments solve persistent social problems. Mogahed is a former director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, where her surveys of Muslim opinion skewered myths and stereotypes, while illuminating the varied attitudes of Muslims toward politics, religion, and gender issues. Her 2008 book with John Esposito entitled Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, outlines these surprising findings. In this personal and powerful talk, Mogahed asks us, in this polarizing time, to fight negative perceptions of her faith in the media and to choose empathy over prejudice. Let's listen to Dahlia Mogahed.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and Partner Events. This episode features Muslim Studies scholar Dahlia Mogahed. Here's Dahlia Mogahed.
What do you think when you look at me? A woman of faith? An expert? Maybe even a sister? Or oppressed, brainwashed, a terrorist? Or just an airport security line delay? That one's actually true. If some of your perceptions were negative, I don't really blame you. That's just how the media has been portraying people who look like me. One study found that 80% of news coverage about Islam and Muslims is negative. And studies show that Americans say that most don't know a Muslim. I guess people don't talk to their Uber drivers. Well, for those of you who've never met a Muslim, it's great to meet you. Let me tell you who I am. I'm a mom, a coffee lover, double espresso cream on the side. I'm an introvert. I'm a wannabe fitness fanatic, and I'm a practicing spiritual Muslim. But not like Lady Gaga says, because baby, I wasn't born this way. It was a choice. When I was 17, I decided to come out. No, not as a gay person like some of my friends, but as a Muslim, and decided to start wearing the hijab, my head covering. My feminist friends were aghast. Why are you oppressing yourself? The funny thing was, it was actually at that time a feminist declaration of independence. From the pressure I felt as a 17-year-old to conform to a perfect and unattainable standard of beauty. I didn't just passively accept the faith of my parents. I wrestled with the Quran. I read and reflected and questioned and doubted and ultimately believed. My relationship with God, it was not love at first sight. It was a trust and a slow surrender that deepened with every reading of the Quran. Its rhythmic beauty sometimes moves me to tears. I see myself in it. I feel that God knows me. Have you ever felt like someone sees you, completely understands you, and yet loves you anyway? That's how it feels. And so later, I got married, and like all good Egyptians, started my career as an engineer. I later had a child after getting married, and I was living essentially the Egyptian-American dream. And then that terrible morning of September 2001. I think a lot of you probably remember exactly where you were that morning. I was sitting in my kitchen, finishing breakfast, and I look up on the screen and see the words breaking news. There was smoke, airplanes flying into buildings, people jumping out of buildings. What was this? An accident? A malfunction? My shock quickly turned to outrage. Who would do this? And I switched the channel and I hear, Muslim terrorist, in the name of Islam, Middle Eastern descent, jihad. We should bomb Mecca. Oh my God. Not only had my country been attacked, but in a flash, somebody else's actions had turned me from a citizen to a suspect. That same day, we had to drive across Middle America to move to a new city to start grad school. And I remember sitting in the passenger seat as we drove in silence, crouched as low as I could go in my seat for the first time in my life, afraid for anyone to know I was a Muslim. We moved into our apartment that night in a new town in what felt like a completely different world. And then I was hearing and seeing and reading warnings from national Muslim organizations saying things like, be alert, be aware, stay in well-lit areas, don't congregate. I stayed inside all week. And then it was Friday that same week, the day that Muslims congregate for worship. And again, the warnings were, don't go that first Friday. It could be a target. And I was watching the news, wall-to-wall coverage. Emotions were so raw, understandably. And I was also hearing about attacks on Muslims or people who were perceived to be Muslim being pulled out and beaten in the street. Mosques were actually firebombed. And I thought, we should just stay home. And yet, something didn't feel right. Because those people who attacked our country attacked our country. I get it that people were angry at the terrorists. Guess what? So was I. And so to have to explain yourself all the time isn't easy. I don't mind questions. I love questions. It's the accusations that are tough. Today we hear people actually saying things like, there's a problem in this country, and it's called Muslims. When are we going to get rid of them? So some people want to ban Muslims and close down mosques. They talk about my community kind of like we're a tumor in the body of America. And the only question is, are we malignant or benign? You know, a malignant tumor, you extract altogether, and a benign tumor, you just keep under surveillance. The choices don't make sense because it's the wrong question. Muslims, like all other Americans, aren't a tumor in the body of America. We're a vital organ. Thank you. Muslims are inventors and teachers, first responders and Olympic athletes. Now, is closing down mosques going to make America safer? It might free up some parking spots, but it will not end terrorism. Going to a mosque regularly is actually linked to having more tolerant views of people of other faiths and greater civic engagement. And as one police chief in the Washington, D.C. area recently told me, people don't actually get radicalized at mosques. They get radicalized in their basement or bedroom in front of a computer. And what you find about the radicalization process is it starts online, but the first thing that happens is the person gets cut off from their community, from even their family, so that the extremist group can brainwash them into believing that they, the terrorists, are the true Muslims, and everyone else who abhors their behavior and ideology are sellouts or apostates. So if we want to prevent radicalization, we have to keep people going to the mosque. Now, some will still argue Islam is a violent religion. After all, a group like ISIS bases its brutality on the Quran. Now, as a Muslim, as a mother, as a human being, I think we need to do everything we can to stop a group like ISIS. But we would be giving in to their narrative if we cast them as representatives of a faith of 1.6 billion people. Thank you. ISIS has as much to do with Islam as the Ku Klux Klan has to do with Christianity. Both groups claim to base their ideology on their holy book. But when you look at them, they're not motivated by what they read in their holy book. It's their brutality that makes them read these things into the scripture. Recently, a prominent imam told me a story that really took me aback. He said that a girl came to him because she was thinking of going to join ISIS. And I was really surprised and asked him, had she been in contact with a radical religious leader? And he said the problem was quite the opposite, that every cleric that she had talked to had shut her down and said that her rage, her sense of injustice in the world, was just going to get her in trouble. And so with nowhere to channel and make sense of this anger, she was a prime target to be exploited by extremists promising her a solution. What this imam did was to connect her back to God and to her community. He didn't shame her for her rage. Instead, he gave her constructive ways to make real change in the world. What she learned at that mosque prevented her from going to join ISIS. And I've told you a little bit about how Islamophobia affects me and my family, but how does it impact ordinary Americans? How does it impact everyone else? How does consuming fear 24 hours a day affect the health of our democracy, the health of our free thought? Well, one study, actually several studies in neuroscience, show that when we're afraid, at least three things happen. We become more accepting of authoritarianism, conformity, and prejudice. One study showed that when subjects were exposed to news stories that were negative about Muslims, they became more accepting of military attacks on Muslim countries and policies that curtail the rights of American Muslims. Now, this isn't just academic. When you look at when anti-Muslim sentiment spiked between 2001 and 2013, it happened three times, but it wasn't around terrorist attacks. It was in the run-up to the Iraq War and during two election cycles. So Islamophobia isn't just the natural response to Muslim terrorism, as I would have expected. It can actually be a tool of public manipulation, eroding the very foundation of a free society, which is rational and well-informed citizens. Muslims are like canaries in the coal mine. We might be the first to feel it, but the toxic air of fear is harming us all. And assigning collective guilt isn't just about having to explain yourself all the time. Dia and his wife, Yusr, were a young married couple living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where they both went to school. Dia was an athlete, and he was in dental school, talented, promising. And his sister would tell me that he was the sweetest, most generous human being she knew. She was visiting him there, and he showed her his resume, and she was amazed. She said, "When did my baby brother become such an accomplished young man?" Just a few weeks after Suzanne's visit to her brother and his new wife, their neighbor, Craig Stephen Hicks, murdered them, as well as Yosra's sister, Roseanne, who was visiting for the afternoon, in their apartment, execution style, after posting anti-Muslim statements on his Facebook page. He shot Dia 8 times. So bigotry isn't just immoral, it can even be lethal. So back to my story, what happened after 9/11? Did we go to the mosque or did we play it safe and stay home? Well, we talked it over, and it might seem like a small decision, but to us it was about what kind of America we wanted to leave for our kids, one that would control us by fear, or one where we were practicing our religion freely. So we decided to go to the mosque, and we put my son in his car seat, buckled him in, and we drove silently, intensely to the mosque. And I took him out, I took off my shoes, I walked into the prayer hall. And what I saw made me stop. The place was completely full. And then the imam made an announcement, thanking and welcoming our guests, because half the congregation were Christians, Jews, Buddhists, atheists, people of faith and no faith, who had come not to attack us, but to stand in solidarity with us. I just break down at this time. These people were there because they chose courage and compassion over panic and prejudice. What will you choose? What will you choose at this time of fear and bigotry? Will you play it safe Or will you join those who say, we are better than that? Thank you.
So, Dahlia, you seem to have struck a chord, but I wonder, what would you say to those who might argue that you're giving a TED talk, you're clearly a deep thinker, you work at a fancy think tank, you're an exception, you're not the rule. What would you say to those people?
I would say, don't let this stage distract you. I'm completely ordinary. I'm not an exception. My story is not unusual. I am as ordinary as they come. When you look at Muslims around the world, and I've done this, I've done the largest study ever done on Muslims around the world, people want ordinary things. They want prosperity for their family, they want jobs, and they want to live in peace. So I am not in any way an exception. When you meet people who seem like an exception to the rule, oftentimes it's that the rule is broken, not that they're an exception to it. Thank you so much.
Dahlia Mogahed.
Thank you.
That was Dahlia Mogahed, recorded at TED in February of 2016. This is Panangara, and you are listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Stay tuned for Uber Jazz at 3 p.m. Eastern and more non-traditional independent programming. Party 93.4 is a project of the Freeform Radio Initiative, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide diverse and innovative online broadcasting that reflects the interests and concerns of the community. If you like the program that you've been listening to, please consider supporting the Freeform Radio Initiative by making a tax-deductible donation. You can go to the website at freeformradio.org or party934.com and click on the donate button. Thanks in advance for your support. I would also like to invite you to sign up for the e-newsletter. It's a simple way to show your support and a great way to keep tabs on the Freeform Radio Initiative. You can sign up by going to party934.com and fill in the entry field with your email address. It's that simple. This is Panangara, your mixologist for Barkata Circle and storytelling for nonprofits. Thank you once again for listening. Till next time, discover how telling your story will spark another story from someone across the table or perhaps across the globe, so you can make meaningful connections, foster understanding, and bring about real change in people's lives. Have a great week.